I think I've recovered from Avengers Infinity War.
I think I have too. No, 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 it's too soon. Damn it. No. Right. No.
We won't say any more about it. We did see it last weekend and... Yeah. I will say no more.
Feels.
Say no more.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more.
Hey, governor.
Yeah.
There you going?
I nod.
How's your father?
I nod as good as a wink to a blind bat, don't you know?
Monty Python?
Yeah, Monty Python. Monty Python.
As you do.
Where else can you get someone in a podcast form who goes from Avengers to Monty Python in the space of 30 seconds? I mean, really.
Yeah,
that's the sort of value we bring you.
We're very gifted like that.
Yeah, on a history podcast, no less.
Not sure if gifted is the right word, but I'm running with that.
Yeah, we'll run with whatever we can, really.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
hello everyone.
Hello. So, shall we do this thing?
We shall do this thing.
Woohoo! What the? History. Hello and welcome to the What the History podcast, your fortnightly bits of bizarre history that can make even you say what the history. I am Trevor Holland, and I am joined by...
Susie Holland.
And we have got some awesome, awesome stuff for you this time around. So, Susie, will you please take it from here?
I will. And first I'd like to say hi, everyone, again, and I hope you're feeling very well today.
Lovely.
Isn't it? Because yes, we love you all of you. Mwah. But firstly, and next... It's a public holiday in Queensland.
Mm.
You can tell. Okay, but without further ado, that's the right one?
That's fine.
Okay, I've got an interesting tale for you. Tales of the boogeyman have been around for many years to caution or frighten people, usually children, into being good and to follow the rules. Other countries have the Der Schwarzmann from Germany, Hombre de Saco from Spain, the Jersey Devil from the USA, and don't forget the Brothers Grimm Book of Stories, some which had a cautionary tale of not straying off the good path. And then you have the Boogeyman from merry old England, the well-named Spring Heel Jack. Spring Heel Jack terrorised parts of England for over 60 years, and was firstly just a rumour when, in 1837, people crossing over Barnes Common in southwest London saw a figure jumping through the air at great speed and across their path. The stories persisted and were confirmed in 1838 when a woman by the name of Jane Allsop, who lived in Bow, East London, answered the violent knocking on the door. The shadowed figure told her that he was a policeman and asked her to bring a light as he had caught Spring-Heeled Jack. Jane duly went and got a light and walked out the door, excited that she was going to see the London Terror being arrested, when the man grabbed Jane by the neck and put her in a headlock, ripping at her dress and body. She screamed and tore herself away, but the man gave chase and caught Jane by her hair and clawed at her neck. Jane got away when a sister, hearing Jane's screams, raised the alarm, but the man disappeared into the darkness. Jane described to the law enforcement officials that the man who assaulted her had eyes like balls of fire, clawed hands, and he vomited blue and white flames. He also had a white tight-fitting suit and helmet. Other people described Jack as wearing armour or red shoes and being the size of a large white bull. The press went for the story of Jack, but mostly was sceptical. A few days later, Lucy Scales of Limehouse, East London, was walking home in the evening with her sister when a figure jumped out at her, spat blue flames into her face, causing blindness and a seizure. These two stories received more publicity than the other stories from Barnes Common due to their more city location and showed the people that Spring Heel Jack was close by. This description was often repeated when other people encountered Spring-Heeled Jack in the 1850s and 60s. He was sighted over England mainly in the Midlands. In the 1870s, the army set traps as sentrymen were set upon by a man slapping them in the darkness and springing onto their sentry boxes in Aldershot, approximately 50 km southwest of London. Jack was shot at in Lincoln in the East Midlands in 1877, but he laughed and disappeared into the darkness. He doesn't sound like a very nice person or creature. After the attacks in 1838, Jack became the stuff of legend and appeared in penny dreadfuls beginning in 1886, which carried the title Spring Hill Jack, the Terror of London. In these stories, Jack was everyone from a figure against authority of the army. There was actually a penny dreadful cover from 1904 of Jack leaping down on a group of soldiers, brandishing a pistol with the words, "A leap for liberty," akin to some sort of folk hero against the establishment, to a supernatural menace. But no one could capture Jack. It was suggested that Jack was actually a group of wealthy men scaring people for fun and money, with the Lord Mayor of London, John Cowan, supporting this theory in 1838. This didn't stop the legend surrounding Jack from growing, or a number of Victorian parents from threatening their children to keep on the straight and narrow, lest Spring Hill Jack would visit them on dark nights. In 1904, Jack made his last recorded appearance in Liverpool, in the northwest of England, 67 years, well done, after the first sightings on Barnes Common, this time leaping from rooftop to rooftop and leaping up and down the street. Then he disappeared into the darkness as quickly as he came, perhaps forever. The legend surrounding Spring Hill Jack has come from sightings, newspaper articles, the penny dreadfuls, and is represented in steampunk culture and now modern comics and magazines. The penny dreadful stories give Jack a backstory with the way he became Spring Hill Jack. And they are fascinating, actually, and I encourage you to check them out.
Absolutely. Actually, yeah. Interestingly, any gamers out there, if you play Assassin's Creed, the one set in London,
around the 1880s.
Syndicate? Assassin's Creed Syndicate? I think that's the one. There is actually a plot line involving Spring Hill Jack, and it takes you underground to a secret society. Probably inspired a bit by that whole wealthy men group scaring people. So it's quite an interesting little aside.
Yeah, I think it actually was. It seems to me that it was the wealthy men and, you know, carrying on like absolute idiots for shits and giggles.
That's the mystery of what the history.
So yeah, make up your own mind. Was he one person? Was he many people? Did he exist? Why did he come about?
Yeah. Who knows?
Why is he such a pain in the butt?
Oh, the spring-loaded trouble.
I know. Very spring-loaded.
Yeah. Bouncing off and causing mayhem.
Can't take him anywhere.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Springs. Who knows what they'll do next?
Can't help.
You know, they could even relate to my next What the History.
Yay! Nice segue.
I'm proud of that one.
Take it away. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So many things have been banned over the years. Alcohol, tobacco, Kinder Surprise Eggs, an episode of Peppa Pig, Claire Danes. The list goes on, and some of these may feature in future What the Histories.
Yeah.
Most people are particularly aware of the era of Prohibition in the USA, where alcohol was banned for 13 years. But this pales in comparison to another pastime, one that I am personally a big fan of, that was banned in various parts of America for over 30 years. Now, I know you're all wondering what this hedonistic hobby of mine can be. What perilous pastime do I particularly enjoy? What evil is it Okay, you get the idea. I enjoy pinball.
Oh!
Yep.
Shocked. Gasp.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at the Rufus Project YouTube channel, I play some online. You can look at that later. I'll plug it later. Okay.
Yes, one credit challenge.
Yes. And yes, pinball. The game of silver balls, gleaming lights, dazzling sounds, and quick reflexes. A game that surprisingly dates back to the court of King Louis XVI, where its ancestor, a game called Bagatelle, comprised of a billiard table with pins arranged on it. Players would bowl a ball across the table. I don't know what the full rules were, that was just the very Cliff Notes version. Through a series of updates, this eventually led to coin-operated versions, which used a spring to launch the ball into action, and the pinball machine was born in the early 1930s. The fact that there was no real way to influence the ball, they had no flippers at the time, meant that these original machines were games of chance, and that's basically the root of the problem. On the back of prohibition of liquor, legislators set their sights on gambling and saw little difference between slot machines and pinball. Both were coin-operated, and with pinball rewarding high scores with free games, and many owners of machines offering prizes, it wasn't long until bans started being passed, with machines being taken and destroyed. This was encouraged by moral crusaders, who said that children were missing out on meals as they were pumping their lunch money into the machines, with some even saying any increase in crime was due to the pinball-corrupted youth going out and stealing to get more money to feed into pinball tables. Oh, won't someone think of the children? Sorry, a little personal bias slipped in there. Now, because it was the 30s and 40s and pinball was making heaps of money, it was linked with the mafia in Chicago, who had links with manufacturers and were certainly turning a profit because of it. Now, opponents of the game took full advantage of America joining World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. The mayor of New York City and longtime pinball opponent Fiorelli LaGuardia wasted no time in declaring materials were being wasted in pinball machines and that it would be, quote, infinitely preferable that the metal in these evil contraptions be manufactured into arms and bullets which can be used to destroy our foreign enemies, end quote. Then there's fighting words. In January of 1942, the New York police raided establishments and confiscated over 2,000 pinball machines. Mayor LaGuardia put on a show for the press, where he and the chiefs of police smashed the machines with sledgehammers, I'm going to cry, before sending the remains out on garbage barges to be dumped in the river. So much for using the material for the war effort. Oops, sorry, a little more personal bias slipped through again.
That's just awful.
Other cities followed suit and full-on prohibition had begun. Pinball was forced underground and was soon associated with anti-establishment culture, often pictured as being played by leather jacket-wearing rebellious youths with cigarettes hanging out of their mouths, greaser haircuts, and bad attitudes. Despite all this opposition, people continued to try to improve the game, and a big breakthrough occurred in 1947 when the Humpty Dumpty table was released by Gottlieb. The revolutionary addition of flippers was, and please excuse the pun, a game changer. With flippers added in this and future machine, players were able to demonstrate skill on the tables and greatly reduce the element of chance. Slowly but surely, the ban on pinball started to fade away. However, it wasn't until 1974 that the Supreme Court of the United States finally declared pinball was more a game of skill than of chance. The city of New York was not having any of that, though, and their ban remained in place. 2 years later, in 1976, okay, started in the 30s, remember, New York was in poor financial state and was facing bankruptcy. A solution was put forward suggesting that the licensing of pinball tables could provide beneficial to the city. It did not go unopposed, with one councilman suggesting, quote, it will bring rampant vice and gambling back to the city.
I don't think it ever left.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was already there. The solution to the dilemma was to have a pinball demonstration for the councillors to show whether or not it was actually a game of skill. The man selected to defend the honour of pinball was Roger Sharp, a writer and one of the top pinball players in the country. He was to play a table he was very skilled at, with a number of backup tables on hand in case the first one malfunctioned. However, on the day, one of the opposing councilmen was concerned that the pinballers, as he referred to them, may have tampered with the main table and insisted on that one of the backups be used instead. Another table was presented, one that Roger had much less experience with. The presentation was not going well, and then Roger decided the best way to prove pinball was a game of skill was to call a shot. Stating that he could make the ball go through the center lane of the table on his very next shot, Roger pulled back the plunger and prepared to make the shot that would determine the future of pinball in New York. He released the plunger, the ball flew up the launch ramp, down to the flippers, and Roger neatly shot it back through the center lane, proving to all that pinball was indeed a game of skill. The ban was lifted, enabling New York to make an estimated $1.5 million from the licensing of tables. Interestingly, in 1978, there was a push to ban pinball tables in any venue that was not a licensed amusement hall in Australia. Thankfully, this one didn't go through, but still added an extra twist to this tale of what the history.
Oh, yes. I actually do like pinballs. I can't play them very well anymore, but my uncle used to teach me how to play, and it was, you know, one of the rites of passage as a young teenage girl being taken to show her first pinball table, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh,
yeah. And my another family members had an Egyptian one in the pool room of their house.
So jealous.
It was beautiful. It was by the company Bally.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what it was called. I think it was like Tutankhamun's Curse or something. And I'm just going, oh, my God. Because those who know me know that I love Egyptology. And it was, oh, go. It was gorgeous. But mostly it was out of commission. And my family used it as a laundry folding table. It was sad. I just used to sit there and look at it and pretend I was still playing, even though it wasn't, you know, joined up or anything, and it had no money in it and stuff. But oh God, it was beautiful.
It was
art.
Yeah,
beautiful art.
If I had the funds and the possibilities, this house would have pinball tables.
Oh yeah. Oh God, yeah.
But we have to resign ourselves to heading off once a month to a little place called Netherworld, where they have like a Sunday morning where people can bring their family to play all the old pinball tables and arcade games.
It's brilliant. Oh, God, I love that place so much. Centipede! Yay!
We are not sponsored by Netherworld.
No, we're not. But if Netherworld wants to get in contact.
We do advise you, Netherworld, if you happen to hear this. Yes. Well, that was odd.
That was good. Oh, no. It's a lovely place. And Trev's favourite table is the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. So if you ever are in Netherworld on a Sunday morning for the Little Monsters event, who knows? The hosts of What the History may well be there.
We will probably be there.
We haven't missed one yet.
Take the kids.
I'm happy to say that our youngest does quite like the pinball tables too. So
yeah, it's so beautiful to see.
Yeah. I want to play pinball now.
Oh, me too. I want to get back, you know, find that Tutankhamun's Curse one.
I'll have to see if I can find a digital version.
Oh, it was just beautiful. I think it was called that. I'm not 100% sure, but oh, the artwork was just...
I'll go see what table.
It was stunning. It was a 1970s, you know, early 80s pinball.
See if it's available through the old pinball arcade.
Yeah, I'll tell you which one it is and I'll know for sure then.
And we're not sponsored by pinball arcade either. But still, if you like pinball, check that thing out.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
I'm
just geeking out of a pinball now. Let's get back on task. And we hope you have enjoyed this spring-loaded episode of What the History. Now, if you do want to know more about what we've discussed, all our references are down in the links below. If you're on YouTube, there'll be a link to the podcast page, which will have all the links. And interestingly, I've actually included the news story from 1978 about the proposed pinball ban. Oh my God, the fashions, but my God, the pinball tables.
Art, pure art. You know,
now, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do that easily. You can head to our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com, where you can leave comments below this very episode. You can find us on Facebook. Look for the What the History podcast page there. We're on Twitter at pod_what. We're on the Twitter.
I use the internet.
Yep.
On the line.
You can use the hashtag WTHpod as well. Or you can send us an email to WTHpod@rufusproject.com. We would love to hear from you. And look, if you want to contribute funds towards us getting a pinball table, we wouldn't say no to that either. Why not be totally shameless?
Oh, gosh, you're shocking.
So, on that shameless note, we hope you have...
I'm shaking my head at you. Oh, my God.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode, and we will be back in a couple of weeks' time with two more fantastic tales from history to make you say, what the history?
Good night, everyone.
Farewell.